The 2003 Sunstone Symposium West, held in San Francisco on April 19th, presents session number 62, The Journal of Caroline Barnes Crosby, by Edward Leo Lyman, with a response by Chris Corbett.
Okay, this is session 62, The Journal of Caroline Barnes Crosby. Our presenter, is the microphone on? You can hear? Okay. Our presenter is Leo Lyman, who has a long history of making presentations at Sunstone and of researching and writing in the field of Mormon history. He tells me that he discovered the journals of Caroline Barnes Crosby while he was preparing a book about the Mormon history of San Bernardino, his great-grandfather having been the mayor. He lives in Victorville, where he teaches at the community college. Our respondent is Chris Corbett, who is an attorney representing, she says, the shrinking technical companies in Palo Alto. And she has a great interest in 19th century American history. Okay.
Thank you. There's some dilemma about when the meager supply of slides that I have should be presented. But because I'm trying to split the East Bay Area part of the talk and the San Francisco part, I've decided that maybe we'll leave the lights on until I'm finished with the East Bay and show the few visual pictures we have of that, and then some non-Mormon slides of Carolyn's time in San Francisco. We have Lauren Hansen in the back here, who knows a heck of a lot more about Washington Township than I do. But right here is, as he has shown me, the Maori's Landing. Now, does everybody know where we're talking about? Fremont, Newark, Mission San Jose over there, Centerville, a center of Mormon activity where, Lauren, would you say that that's the first Anglo schoolhouse in Alameda County?
Yes, that's right.
John Horner being the first Anglo farmer, and this is the schoolhouse where the church met every week, along with several Protestant groups that they loaned the building to. In fact, many times when the Mormons came to the church service, some of the Protestants were just finishing a burial and invited the Mormons to the funeral before they started their own meeting. Caroline Barnes Crosby kept a very detailed journal through her years in California, more than she did at any time before that, but she goes back to the Kirtland period. She didn't live very long in Nauvoo, but she lived in Nauvoo. She and her husband, Jonathan, were in Indiana several years before going to Nauvoo. Then they crossed to Iowa and were in winter quarters until 48 and made the pioneer trek to Utah in 48. A little loud, huh?
Just a little.
Okay, we could. Nobody's ever told me to quiet down my whole life. They didn't stay in Salt Lake very long before her sister, Louisa Barnes Pratt, volunteered them to accompany the group of missionaries to Tahiti. In a selfish way, she wanted company out in Tahiti, which she considered quite uncivilized. Louisa, not Carolyn. The contrast between those two sisters is just amazing, and both their diaries will be published in that Utah State University series. The Louisa diary is already published. The Carolyn will be. We're trying to get them to break the rules by doing a second volume of Carolyn's life when she's an older woman in Beaver, Utah. So if you've got an extra $10,000 you want to give away, you can donate it to that and it'll get published. When they came to California on their way to Tahiti, They became familiar with San Francisco in the early 1850s. Then they were in Tahiti a couple years, and then back to San Francisco. But as soon as they got to San Francisco, they got offers to come across the bay to where John Horner had already started establishing a very impressive agricultural community. He had been one of the Brooklyn Saints, and very early after his arrival in Yerba Buena, he started investigating land in Alameda County, and is supposedly the first Anglo to build a house in the county. Not particularly successful at Mormon Island and the other gold camps that many Mormons were in, at least 200 in Mormon Island, which is under Lake Folsom. We visited there this week. But like many others, including gamblers and prostitutes and saloon keepers, John Horner learned to mine the miners by producing potatoes and vegetables and other kinds of food that sold at very high prices in the gold fields. And eventually he acquired and fenced several thousand acres in the Mission San Jose area, which many of us, until Lauren told us different, thought was in San Jose. But it's really closer to Fremont, isn't it? Newark. Which town do you live in, brother?
Niles.
And there's a main street, Mowry, isn't there, in the area? Named for a Mormon. And a school named Mowry. Charles, do they use the first name? Okay. Interesting. There were an amazing number of other church-related people in the East Bay. One of them is a Mormon battalion guy named Nagley, but in his California years, Naley. And he, too, had prospered considerably in agriculture, and he offered Jonathan Crosby $100 a month and board, a very good offer in 1852, to come over into the East Bay to help the Portuguese workmen who had built this two-story adobe structure finish the project with plastering and painting and wallpapering, as well as maybe taking a contract for tenant farming. Most of the years the Crosbys are there, potatoes and wheat don't do nearly as well as they did the years when Horner and Naley made most of their money. Obviously, this area is important partly because of the Maori schooner that crosses the bay from San Francisco. And that's how the Crosbys got to this area. And we'll see a slide of this swampy area. And Maori, is it Boulevard or Avenue? That goes basically from there toward the foothills. When after they see these really beautiful grassy flower-strewn plains, the Crosbys get to the Naley Adobe, which is a deaf school now?
That's where the state school for deaf and blind.
Some of you know where that area is. That was Naley's adobe and part of his farm, and where the Crosbys lived for well over a year. And they didn't get there the first day because the launch didn't get to its landing before the tide and the winds changed, and they had to spend the night probably in the mosquitoes on the launch and arrived at where they were supposed to be the next morning. Met by Harley Mowry, who was another Mormon battalion, son of Charles. Charles has got three or four sons, several who become spiritualists like he does, and several who are faithful Latter-day Saints like Harley, who married the widow of one of the battalion members at Pueblo, Colorado, came on to Utah in 47, and after this period of time, we'll go to San Bernardino, where many of the faithful saints are. When the Crosbys get to the Naley Rancho and Adobe, Carolyn notices the white sacks filled with grain. Now, California has never been noted for its wheat production, but certainly there was a market in the gold fields for wheat. And Naley, at least in 1852, whatever the price, did fairly well with that. But he's going looking for a wife after that, and he'll leave the farm to Crosby, who works all year basically for nothing the next year. Carolyn is the cook and housekeeper, and during a grain harvest, you'll have two dozen people operating mechanical binders and reapers and threshers, and part of the process is you board and room on the ranch premises during the week or whatever it takes to do the threshing. And she has the job of feeding. In one diary entry, 15, in another, 21. And she labored that year or more, almost for nothing, just like her husband did. During this time, the church activity is a constant mention in Carolyn Barnes Crosby's fabulous diary. Fabulous for the interaction, fabulous for the social contacts that are recorded. Better than I've ever seen in a diary. Now, I don't know why there aren't as many Mormon women diaries from the 1850s as there are men. Although Carolyn, in her last years, writes her diary in the margin of a catalog, if you can imagine. So paper availability is a problem, especially for those who are not doing well. And people that have been asked to move, she's abandoned at least five nice homes as the church has moved. And I'm sorry if anybody's from Beaver, but ending up there in a really cold but nice-looking place is not a step away from the celestial kingdom, like maybe San Bernardino had been when she was there. She had the most admired house in San Bernardino. She was asked to leave it, not knowing where she was going or what she was it was going to be like. And in that whole diary, there's not one bit of complaint. Now, that qualifies somebody for the celestial kingdom. I'm not the judge, but if I were, I would admit her based just on that. Church activity is mostly in the Horner Schoolhouse. Moved once, but mainly during this period, Centerville. Can you give us an address, Lauren, basically, where it was, where it was by the cemetery?
Well, right where the train tracks cross the Mount Boulevard, right there. And,
where there aren't many Mormons, they're moved to other places, but it is an active cemetery, isn't it?
Not the Central Cemetery.
Isn't it? I saw people working on it when we were there, but they weren't burying people. Yes, that's right. Among many people that are passing through the congregation on the east side of the bay are the Skinners, who will later be in San Bernardino, and the Tompkins, Thomas Tompkins family, Horace Skinner family, both of whom will go to San Bernardino later. Tompkins had been involved in that Tahitian mission. John and Mary Carter were with the Crosbys on the trek from Salt Lake City to California. Sister Reeser, her husband had been in the Mormon battalion. Alfonso Farnsworth, somewhat related to the Skinners. He will marry one of the Australian women that comes to San Bernardino later. And many of these people will end up in Beaver, as the Crosbys did. A lot of prayer meetings held in the Horner home. Not just the church services in the schoolhouse. Henry Jacobs is there from the Goldfields. Once married to Zina Huntington, but Brigham's married to her by this time. And that's probably a whole other story that I won't get into. William Hyde, one of the most infamous apostates in church history, still faithful when he preaches to the people in the East Bay on his way to the Hawaiian mission, where he left the church very early and became one of the most outspoken opponents. A whole chapter in the book that Bagley edited on George Q. Cannon. Nathan Tanner, the original Nathan Tanner, one of Amos Lyman's favorite brothers-in-law, has been called on a mission to Hawaii, but doesn't do well with the climate. He's actually trying to purchase a boat to get converts from Hawaii to California without much support from Brigham. But Hyde and Tanner, before they get to Hawaii, are preaching in the East Bay. John Cheney is there. But the most substantial pillar of the church is John M. Horner. He's president of the branch and is described by Carolyn as very dedicated, preaches sometimes on the Book of Mormon, which very few do in this period of time. They actually hold a regional conference in the East Bay that people from San Francisco come over across to attend. And in that particular conference, Horner spoke with remarkable eloquence, she says. One of her shirt-tail relatives is a sister, Woodbury, who comes there with tuberculosis, leaving her husband as a missionary in Hawaii, and she'll die in a few more months in San Bernardino. There's a brother Schaefer, Cyrus Canfield, who will go to San Bernardino and was probably a battalion brother. Brother Wandell. Will has talked a lot about him in a book he just put out this last year. A missionary from Australia. And he's there and he preaches. In fact, Horner sent Wandell to San Bernardino to represent the Bay Area at the California Church Conference, probably in the spring of 53. Quartus Sparks, who will later go to San Bernardino and will later be disfellowshipped by the San Francisco branch, is an eloquent speaker. And although he's never the ecclesiastical presiding elder or branch president, he is often designated as the main preacher. There are quite a few burials of Mormons and others connected to these Sabbath services. And more than a few times, that schoolhouse is nearly full of not just church members, but people who are investigating or coming to observe. There are several Welch brethren in the East Bay, including a guy named Morris. And I'll mention that later. The social interaction that Carolyn is so good at describing includes frequent dances of Mormons and sometimes Hispanic Gentiles. I guess you can call a Catholic a Gentile, can't you? In the adobe. They'll clear the furniture away. Sometimes the rent for the use of the building for the night through till morning is up to $30 for Carolyn to clean and move the furniture aside. How many of you know what an infare is? It's a wedding reception. Some people married over at the mission hold the reception and party, dance at the Naley Crosby home. In some of the best of the church dances, they have three violins, meaning violin players, and they take turns playing, maybe two playing, while one dances. And sometimes there's a guy that's leaving the church, a young man named James Foxall, who calls these cotillions till sunrise. Now, it's not all exclusive Mormon dances. Here's a 4th of July celebration at Mr. Rolfe's Hotel. It's a feast and then a dance and ball. And it's amazing how much interaction there is between Carolyn's niece, Frances Pratt, Addison and Louise's daughter, and her fiancé, a guy named Jones Dyer, and the former mission at San Jose. Certainly it's 20 years after secularization, but there's still a Catholic church there and apparently a very good pear and peach orchard and lots of, and Carolyn uses the term, feasts of pears and peaches that at least this Mormon couple gets invited to at the San Jose mission. So, this East Bay area, where there are several dozen Mormons pass through, some of whom settle probably permanently. Would you say, Lauren, there are any families that have been there five generations in your stake? Not particularly in the church, but there, right? Yeah. Tough to stay a Mormon five generations. My kids are trying to hold me in now. The landscape is fascinating. I've never seen such beautiful green as I've seen this week in Northern California. And she talks about the verdure and the variegated with flowers, beautifully variegated with flowers. As they go up, there are several canyons not far from to the east of where the Crosbys and the others live in the mission. And they talk about the numerous herds of cattle, sometimes stopping at apparently a hamlet village that's mostly Portuguese. And they're really quite close to a guy named Rose, who's of Portuguese descent. That's not a Portuguese name, I know. But my partner in this project, Sue Payne, is absolutely convinced that Rose is Portuguese. And I'm not about to disagree with her. She's a great lady, and she should have been mentioned in the program somewhere as at least a co-editor, along with the guy that's dead. You ever been associated with the guy that's dead? George Ellsworth is a co-editor of this diary because he started it before we ever inherited it. And Lauren should be, but we'll certainly acknowledge him in the acknowledgments. Like I said, after a year, the Crosbys struck out economically. The prices of potatoes have dropped to where they can't even make any money digging them and hauling them to the Maori Embarcadero for sale or for shipping. And so there's really no future in that or vegetables or wheat, them staying another year, which Naley would have been glad to let them do, although he has returned with his new bride. And they just decide they've got a better opportunity in San Bernardino, where Horner also is going to develop a real estate project in San Francisco. And this is probably as good a time as any to show those slides. Does anybody have a question on the East Bay geography that Lauren Hansen can help us with. There's the Maori Landing. There's the Mission. There's Centerville. Any questions? Why don't you kick those lights off just for a minute and let's... Do we have a way to do that? This is the swamp. Out. Maybe it's up here. That'll probably do. This is, Lauren, wouldn't you say that this is the very channel that the Maoris used?
Yes, I think so.
When was this taken?
This was taken last year, a year and a half ago. This is from the railroad tracks that Lauren mentioned near where the school. It's not near the school, it's near the Nichols house, but it shows the landscape, including some of the water in the area. And my partner decided it would be a typical view of what it would have been like back in 1853. What's not usually. We had to look for a place, and that's not one of the great Mormon homes, but it's one of the oldest. Lauren, how old do you think that is? The Nichols home. The back side of it. We couldn't get it. Is it Edison that owns the... This is in danger, wouldn't you say, Brother Hansen? There's nobody trying to save it?
I'd have to go and look, see if it's still there.
It might not be there. It's been almost 2 years. But it's one of the old Mormon homes where Carolyn visited after church, which she visited somebody every Sunday. This is the Horner brother, who's not a Mormon, William Horner's home. What street's this on?
Driscoll Avenue.
And these are interior views of his home. They're fairly on fairly safe ground that this is the original William Horner home, aren't they, Lauren?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Is this a museum now?
No, it's somebody's home. Yes. It's a great house. And they're still working on it. And certainly there have been additions since the 1850s. This is San Francisco. And that's the Horner subdivision. Horner addition. He didn't keep it. I know you know something of the history of how many squatters, how many contested land titles there are in the San Francisco Bay Area. Maybe you don't know that there was a horrible local panic economic depression that started just when he's trying to develop this in 1854 and 55, 56, almost guaranteeing that he will not succeed. But there is, does anybody know where Elizabeth Street is? Named for his wife? It's not just Brannan that the Mormons named something after. There's an Elizabeth Street in there, and a park, and some other things.
Where is it now? It's called Noe Valley.
Noe was the name of the Hispanic rancher that he bought this from. But it's not very far from the center of San Francisco. All right, let's go through the visual picture of slides in the early 1850s of San Francisco. 1854 from the top of Sacramento Street. And that Montgomery Street. Montgomery looking from California in 1854. This is the Montgomery Building in 56. This is looking toward or from Stockton Street, looking down or California Street looking toward the bay from Stockton Street. And there's a St. Mary's Church there on Grant Avenue. This is an 1853 photo. The Battery Street, north of Sacramento, from California Street in 1856. And this is the San Francisco Mission Dolores, where the Crosbys lived very close to this during their time in San Francisco. Turn on the lights, will you, Will? Maybe we ought to go back to that map and just leave it up. Yeah, leave the lights on. By the way, there are maps. Too loud. I'm sorry.
Thanks.
We'll work on that. Nobody's ever been able to quiet me down.
It was when the lights went on.
With it? I'm usually very timid when the lights are on. We've got both these maps back on the wall if you want to look at those after. And take a closer look. There are even some labels on them. This Horner project was to develop this, and it certainly developed, but not while he was making the profits from it. There are accounts in Carolyn's diary, and here again, she and Jonathan receive an offer that they can't refuse. To share a house, again a large adobe that's somewhat unfinished. They first had rented a house near the old Mission Dolores for $20 a month. But then they moved in with the Horners. It's a big enough adobe for the two families and still a lot of entertaining. It's an adobe house, and the Horners are deeply engaged in trying to clear the title and keep the squatters off. Fences disappear in the night, probably on both sides. And I know that Horner is paying young Mormon men to tear down the fences and haul away the posts in the dark. And he loses the battle, partly because of this economic depression. Now, let me say that this is the year, 1854, when he's volunteered to Brigham to provide the land in East Bay for another Mormon colony like San Bernardino. But he's going to get in too much economic trouble for that to ever come through. I said in my San Bernardino book, it probably would have killed San Bernardino because most of the very faithful that are going there are from the East Bay and San Francisco. But it was the plan, and Brigham had blessed the plan, but Horner's finances hadn't allowed it to be carried to fruition. It's fascinating to see the description of rural San Francisco. Now, isn't that a contradiction in terms? Rural San Francisco? Carolyn's son, Alma, takes a hike in the mountains to the edge of the Presidio, to a lake, without many houses around on his route. And Carolyn and her female associates, who are mostly in the church, walks just like over in the East Bay, gathering flowers, strawberries, blackberries, climbing up hills to where they can see the ships on the bay. And they don't talk a lot about crowds of people where she lives, which is up a hill from the Mission Dolores. She does talk about having to climb the hill to get home. There is, near the mission, a bus stop for a horse-drawn trolley just before the cable cars. And it goes from the mission, which, again, is desecularized or secularized 20 years before, and the car goes down to the plaza in downtown San Francisco. The Horners had a daughter die during this time, and they took her across to Centerville or one of the cemeteries over there to be buried. But they... on the way to church in the downtown San Francisco area from the home, they made a detour past the Yerba Buena Cemetery, where there are 5,000 people buried. Now, see if you can recognize this triangular plot, bordered by McAllister, Market, and Larkin Streets. some pretty high-rise buildings. Not much cemetery there. Now, I'm not saying anybody's still buried there. They probably moved them. But the Horners went over there probably to check out the different kinds of headstones to decide what they wanted to order for their deceased daughter. I believe they lost a son near the same time. Anyway, it's not too far out of their way driving from their home on the hill above the mission to the downtown area where most of the church members' church services are. Let's talk about the church services. How are we doing on time? Okay, I can handle that. You think it's hard to keep me quiet? You try and stop me. Yeah.
On the cemetery, there's a house of refuge within the boundaries of the border addition. Is there any idea what that was?
No, but I bet Lauren knows. I don't remember what it is. When Amos Lyman had come to San Francisco in 1849, he had designated, or maybe it was just really early in 1850, two of the old Brooklyn saints, Ward Pell and George Serine, to gather funds to build a chapel. And that's about, that's the first of three or four times in the 1850s when the San Francisco saints started a building fund. And they never did get one during that time that they actually owned the property. Now, in 1854, when Carolyn's back over there, Lyman is well established in San Bernardino, but most of the funds that he's borrowing, including some from Horner, to buy the San Bernardino ranch, have to be replenished because they're short-term loans. He gets a long-term loan from a couple of French guys named Pioche and Bayrouk, or I don't know how you say that, when in 1854, he's up there a lot, and he probably preaches to the San Francisco Saints quarterly, and he is the head of the California mission. George Q. Cannon will be there in a year or two, but Lyman's still the head for a while. Charles C. Rich is his fellow apostle, but a junior seniority apostle, so Lyman is a popular preacher in San Bernardino and San Francisco. In fact, Carolyn's diary mentions that he preaches to them quite lengthy. It runs in the family, see? And most of the original the services in 53-54 are at Sister Evans's home. Now, her husband had a business in town. I think he's maybe deceased by this time. But that's where they're meeting. And then there's some consideration of renting a building that apparently is owned by George Mowry for public worship house. And Brother Horner, who's now the branch president in San Francisco, said he felt condemned for not trying to make the church more visible in the San Francisco area, and other elders agree. So they want a public worship place beside someone's home. They have a lot of visiting preachers. Charles C. Rich disappoints them by taking a boat down the coast before Sunday several times. Parley P. Pratt's there in the summer of 54 and even in the fall. Lyman's back and Rich in 55. But mostly it's Horner. And visiting missionaries. There is a whole series of missionaries going to the Sandwich Islands, Hawaii, to Asia and other places. An amazingly numerous list that all put in their time preaching until the money's been gathered for them to take passage. George Q. Cannon comes back from his Hawaiian mission and spends some time there. There are, as you probably know, there was a time when fast meeting was on Thursday, and they held those meetings in San Francisco regularly too. Sometimes some of the Welch brethren would come across to preach to Welch in the native language in San Francisco, and Isaac Nash is involved in that. In February 1855, they discussed the propriety of a building a meeting house. Now, apparently they didn't do it right then, but in a while, in 55, they do rent a new meeting place. And they think it's rather humble, but it's on Powell Street, near downtown, just a short distance from Broadway. And it's between two of the Episcopalian and Catholic Church. It's up a couple floors. They use two pair of stairs to get there. Jonathan Crosby, who's a very good Finnish carpenter, made a signboard, a sign saying, hey, if you want to go to the Mormon service, you got to go up the stairs. And there were conferences there. There was a branch at San Juan Bautista. There was one at Santa Clara. Probably pretty close to a branch in the East Bay. And they all send. It's fascinating to look at the vast number of Mormons who will later be fairly famous who pass through. Orson F. Whitney is one of the missionaries to Hawaii. Henry Richards, Joseph F. Smith, who reunites with his cousins, one of whom is later named Ina Culbreth, and spends some time with them, probably boring the heck out of them, telling them to repent and get back in the church. Joseph Peck, George Spires, Robert Curtis, John T. Cain, Edward Partridge Jr., Sixtus Johnson. It's amazing how many of these people reappear in Carolyn's life. When they move back to Utah in 58, they will stay with the Johnson family at Johnson Fort. You know where that is? Enoch, Utah, north of Cedar City. It all is part of the story. Now, one of the most fascinating parts, and I know I'm almost out of time, is Harley P. Pratt, who met a woman named Eleanor McLean in San Francisco. And if you want to know all about that, read the bearded guy's book back there in the back. She was baptized in San Francisco, despite the fact that her current husband, Hector McLean, opposes. She testifies to her zealous feelings about the church in April 54, after she's been baptized. Parley P. Pratt gets there June 29th. And apparently there were sparks, even though his wife Elizabeth is there also. And the interesting part, and it'll probably be part of the book that they write up in Salt Lake to counter Will a little bit, is about the ill feeling of the San Francisco congregation toward Parley P. Pratt. He complains in one church service that members had spoken reproachfully of himself and family, and he declared that they were innocent of any crime. Hustling a married woman is not a crime to Parley Pratt, I guess. Now, Brigham isn't blessing this necessarily, but this is where the problem starts, that Will finishes the story up. And Bringhurst said he didn't make his case very well today, right?
Right.
And I agree with Bringhurst. Us old men, picking on the kid. It's from here, January 55, that McLean takes the kids back to Arkansas? Or do they go to New Orleans first?
New Orleans.
Okay. Anyway, that my partner, Sue Payne, says that the sisters in San Francisco never had any toleration for polygamy. Carolyn is always arguing and defending polygamy. Now, she was a polygamous wife for about 3 months, and then they moved and left the wife in Nauvoo, where she married a French Icarian. So I guess she can defend it because she doesn't have to live with it. But she was faithful enough, she probably would have. It's amazing to me how many threads of Mormon history have roots and ramifications in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I don't believe that all of the people here know that. Brother Hansen.
Sue was working on the diary yesterday about Eddie Jacobs and the polygamy that
Yeah?
You ask Leo about that.
She's afraid I'll ask her about polygamy.
No,
I really like her husband. And I've got all I can handle with one wife. I have appreciated sharing these insights into Mormon community in San Francisco Bay Area in the 1850s, and I believe I've taken my time, so thank you.
Yes.
No, they had the most beautiful home in San Bernardino. They had a shower bath. Everybody came to see.
When were they in San Bernardino?
Right after they almost starved in San Francisco. They probably moved down there at the end of 55, and they'll be there for 2 years. She mentioned that I fell in love with Carolyn's diary because she is so neighborly. She visits somebody every day for 2 years. I mean, you wouldn't believe how social these Mormon women are in San Bernardino. But they were starting even in East Bay and San Francisco.
So she went from East Bay, San Francisco, then San Bernardino.
That's right. And then to Beaver. She couldn't ever escape from Beaver until she died. Now we don't know where she is.
Maya, this not being able to escape from Beaver thing reminds me of my cousin who... She's from Maryland, and in her ward growing up, no one ever wanted to go to BYU because they would come back special, and so she ended up going on, I think she did end up going to BYU after she went to Ricks or something, back when it was Ricks, and she ended up going on a mission, and she was called to the Utah Provo mission, and then she was back in Utah for some reason, you know, met this man who's very, very rooted man, and ended up living in Orem or Provo, and so she laughs all the time about this. Says, Utah is my lot in life.
Her curse.
It's my lot in life. You know, I'm interested in diaries like that. I want to leave enough time for if anyone else has a question for Leo. But this period of the 1850s is really interesting because it's the period when everyone's moving. It's the manifest destiny, right? Everyone's moving forward. And the Mormons are really just a piece of that. But everyone's moving across to the West. And, you know, a lot of... history of Brigham Young, and you all probably know this much more than I do, is Brigham Young says, hey, let's go to winter quarters, and we're moving to California. And apparently some people, even in his wagon train, thought, hey, we're going to California. And sometimes I wonder if the, you know, we're going to stop here is just that he realized how much further they had to go and that they couldn't have gotten there in their current... You have a
comment on that. Utah is part of Upper California. They haven't gotten along with neighbors in New York or Ohio or Illinois or Missouri. Brigham was probably smart to not take Sam Brennan's advice to come to the Bay Area, but to stay out where there aren't any people to quarrel with, except him.
Right. There's a couple other reasons. I was interested to know if Caroline's diary shed any light on maybe some differences, especially because she goes back and forth and then back to Utah. Some differences between Utah and California, because when you look at the period of the 1850s, there's only maybe, before 1900, there's only maybe five or six cities in the western United States that are even to speak of them cities. And Salt Lake is like 40,000 people by later 1800s. Is that?
Yeah. There are more.
Because what I read said by 1890... there's 40,000 people in Salt Lake City. And in San Francisco, there's 100,000. So you're right, it's still pretty rural because there's 100,000 in San Francisco by 60 or 70. So that's, you know, you've had the Sutter's Rush, and then you've had this period of the 54 period where, you know, it's sort of like the period now where you have a big gold rush and then there's some contraction. But they had recovered from that and had come back to, I mean, right now you think 100,000 people, that's Idaho Falls, Idaho. So San Francisco is still pretty rural during that time, but it's quite a bit different from Salt Lake City. In part, you have a huge imbalance of men and women, so it's very kind of a boy town. But it sounds like, from Caroline's diary, and I'm interested to see what you have to say on this, it sounds like from her diary that she's still in the kind of role that maybe women in Utah were in with the visiting the sisters. And
absolutely.
Do you have any comment on that?
If she had had her way, she would have never left Utah. And she can't wait to get back.
Okay, so she does
compare. She's been
compare.
In Tahiti, she's been in San Francisco, she's been in San Bernardino. If you asked her as old lady where she'd rather live, she may not say Beaver, but that's where she had wanted to go all of the way, back to Zion. They really don't have a concept of being fully faithful if they're living outside of Zion. And neither does Brigham. He basically told Lyman once, when you're away from the stove, you get cold, and I guess he's the stove.
That's interesting. No, so there's a couple other reasons, I think, other than, you know, there's this imbalance of men and women, so the movement to Salt Lake City is much more of a family kind of a migration. It's also much more homogenous because the people from in San Francisco, not that everyone was friends, but there are people from, there's still a big presence of Native Americans. There's a lot of people coming from China. Now, a lot of people from China made it into mining in Boise and apparently did very well in Boise and weren't as discriminated against, but you know, times change. But there's also a lot of people from all over in San Francisco. And then the third thing that I think means that maybe the Mormons wouldn't have done so well with their neighbors is that the land was given out differently. So in Upper California, so the Mexican holdings went all the way to north of San Francisco, but not all the way to where North California boundaries are today. So I'd say north of, I don't know exactly where, but
up in
Sonoma. And there were all these great big land holdings. So you have the U.S.-Mexican War, and part of the, when they finally cease the hostilities, part of the agreement is that we'll give, you know, you people can keep your land and you give it out there. So that the title's really different, and more people began by working as wage earners for these large landholders. So it wasn't, whereas in Utah, the Mormons just moved in and kind of said, oh, this is where we live now, and built houses where they were. So there wasn't as much of an opportunity to own the land in the San Francisco area either. But I wanted to see if anyone else had other questions for Leo. I haven't read the book yet, so I don't have... It's more... Yeah.
What other references does she make to Eleanor? She ever mentioned Mr. McLean?
Yeah. In fact, there's one of these missionaries who makes a prophecy that after he vents some bitterness, he'll join the church too. Not a particularly accurate prophecy, since McLean's the one that kills Parley P. Pratt later on in the street in Arkansas. The Crosbys and the Pratts had lived in the same house in Kirtland, but I believe that Pratt wife had died. I don't think it's Elizabeth.
Yes.
But Carolyn knows Elizabeth, but she never... Eleanor never comes out to Carolyn's house. Carolyn doesn't criticize. She records others' criticism, including one place where Sister Sargent, which used to be Lincoln, one of the old San Francisco names, was offended by something Parley said in the worship service and refused to go back. But I don't have any more on Eleanor.
What about
Porter comes to California with Amasa Lyman in late 1849, and the Crosbys are just heading on their mission now. So they met him up in the gold fields, up in Mormon Tavern. There were three or four Mormon taverns, but this is the Lathrop Mormon Tavern. Now, I don't think he's back here then, but he comes to San Bernardino when Carolyn's down there. He has to finish off your guy... What's the name of the place up by Gunlock? Tobin Point. Tobin. He has to finish off Tobin.
He shows up in San Bernardino?
It's in the branch record that he's allegedly around to finish the job that somebody had botched up in your area.
Well, it's probably...
Mount Meadows.
Do you have any specific evidence of that? Besides just he said he'd be here.
Read the San Bernardino book.
He has a daughter.
In fact, she was kidnapped, meaning she married somebody he didn't want her to. And he's in California partly to punish that guy, a Mormon. Yeah, you're right. I don't know what all of the story of that is, but I think we'll know.
You know, I have one other question. Does Caroline show any kind of awareness of any I mean, it seems like she had a lot to do. She's running this motel, essentially.
Yep.
She's got this whole farm, and they're having all these money problems. So she's got a lot to do. But does she, in all this visiting, which is also a little bit different because she'll be visiting, does she visit people mostly that are in her church or her ward, or does she visit more?
There's a young married woman, pregnant woman from New York, that's her nearby neighbor, and she takes really good care of her. The woman has her baby before Carolyn and her associate get over there to help, but they're around, and they're certainly not as exclusive with the Mormons as some of the reports we hear now.
I understand Harley P. Pratt began to hustle Eleanor. Now,
that's probably not a nice word.
Well, I mean, we're trying to figure out exactly what. Was he successful?
Yes.
Also,
she married him, and later she went back to Arkansas to try and get her kids back from her ex-husband.
Against Brigham Young's order.
Against Brigham Young's order. And he partly would be killed back in Arkansas.
Also arguable that she was chasing him because she goes to Salt Lake on her own book and he doesn't immediately marry her.
Yeah, we have to think of the women as actors too.
That's right.
But whether Farley was encouraging her, we really don't know.
There is some reason some of the San Francisco congregation is critical of him, and I suspect that it may relate to that. Does that answer your question, brother?
Yeah, I think so. But it was just that
one more.
Okay.
The questions that are raised now are in my mind.
Yeah. I think there was somebody else before we get back. The guy that always gets the attention. Lauren.
On me?
Yeah.
Well, talking about the Harley P. Pratt and marrying somebody already married, I found in that period of time that they didn't have the nice news we have today working through lawyers and courts.
That's right.
There was a lot of common law marriage and a lot of common law divorces going on. I remember Henry
Jacobs
Green, who was in Fervita, who taught the school of the murder schoolhouse, and finally went down to his friend Bernardino. He gets a letter from his former wife up in Utah and writes back and says, hey, they're telling me you're still using my name. I says, I'm married to somebody else now.
I believe that's Charles C. Rich's sister, his former wife.
That's the one he's referring to?
I think so.
Okay, well, he married somebody else now.
And he may be the missionary who converted Jonathan Crosby in the first place back in New York.
And he eventually became the head of the missionary in all of California.
There are many of these people who slipped into the non-polygamous part of the church. Will.
I know there's some references to spiritualism. When did they start appearing?
The question was, when did the references to spiritualism start appearing?
Benjamin F. Greward is in the East Bay studying Andrew Jackson Davis's books in 1853 or 1854. And Mowry, the guy with the schooner, is a spiritualist. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.